I am working on a document that might be a book someday. And so I have a sheet here called Answers to the Most Frequently Asked Questions About Addiction and Recovery. So this is kind of a lot of the things that I would have probably talked about earlier. And you can pick the sheet up over here. Also, I made some copies of my talk last year, and since most of you were not here last year, or many, I want you to know that these are available, all four for $8. And also, there's a set of handouts that go with these. So if you buy a set of tapes, be sure you let me know you want the handouts too, because I have about 50 pages or more worth of handouts that go with them. And I've also got this suggested reading list. It's several books, and as we're talking about recovery, the Christian ones are all available from the IEGM office. And there's some others that are not necessarily Christian books, but are books that are very good. What I wanted to talk about this afternoon is the fact that we're involved right now in a very interesting project with the Gallup organization. You've heard of the Gallup poll, right? Well, the Gallup organization is involved not just in polling, but also they do a lot of psychological studies and research. And last year in 1992, the Knox Area Rescue Ministry in Knoxville, Tennessee, commissioned a $38,000 study from SRI Gallup to kind of determine what makes or what factors or what identifiable characteristics distinguish homeless people who recover from those who do not. Now, initially, they began kind of on the premise that, well, we have limited resources, we have limited staff, we have limited facilities, so maybe there's some way we can determine which homeless people we should spend the majority of resources on and which ones we feel maybe have a pretty low probability of recovery. But what I took it a little bit beyond what was the original premise, and as the Gallup organization is moving to involve more IUGM missions in their studies, we're trying to develop a national or even international assessment tool that can measure the probability for recovery for homeless people. Now, their basic definition of recovery is that people who are homeless develop meaningful relationships, develop self-worth, establish a home, and become functional members of society. Pretty much what we talked about earlier as far as goals, that they've become people who are truly productive and, of course, involved in as functioning members of society. And so what they did is they narrowed, they took some people that, one group that was determined recovered homeless, one that was determined unrecovered, and their first goal, they developed 339 questions and a big list of life themes or success factors or whatever. And then from there, they interviewed like 60 people or so and narrowed it down to 117 questions. And this one survey is going from just Knoxville now to Lincoln and other cities. And we're still trying to get missions interested in the study. But it's really interesting because it's still in its initial stages, but there are many things that came out of it that I think are worth giving us some things to think about. And so I would like to start by just sharing with you what they saw as the most frequently occurring themes or factors or the things that they saw in the lives of these recovered people that meant that, you know, success had occurred. In other words, what reoccurring themes came up in their interviews that seem to be factors for success. And now we're talking about not a Christian organization, okay? We're talking about a secular organization looking at rescue missions, looking at rescue mission clients and former clients, and saying what things or what do they have going on in their lives today that make them successful and what things don't. And so what do you think, this would be number one, the number one thing that would differentiate the homeless who recovered from the homeless who did not? The spiritual, that's right. We've known that all along, haven't we? Yeah, right. Spiritual. That's a dynamic that they said was the most commonly reoccurring theme. But, interestingly enough, the differential wasn't vast. It was just a very, very, very few fractions of a percentage point from the next one. What do you think that would be? Huh? Nope. Self-insight. That a person understood himself. That's interesting, because if you look at this, all this discussion about toxic shame that we had earlier, and then tomorrow I want to talk a little bit more about the alcoholic's denial system and ways that we can break through the alcoholic's denial system. Well, if I'm in denial, I cannot have self-insight. Impossible. The next one was even more incredible. And we may not always think of it, but it was security. I should read for you exactly their definitions of these things here. What do they mean when they mean spiritual? These people have a high evidence of a spiritual theme when they believe in God, pray regularly, read the Bible, and describe themselves as born-again Christians. As they grow in the spiritual, they become more discriminating in their activities. They know what their religion is, attend church regularly, belong to a church. And this theme seems to be very important in the beginning of the recovery of homeless persons. The spirituality seems to not only strengthen the person individually, it also seems to be the basis for a commonality in building relationships with other people. And you notice we talked about, again, how one of the toxic shame issues is a severing of relationships with other people. They're saying, number one, that the spirituality is one of the things that motivates people in the beginning to come out of this lifestyle, and it binds them with other people. So the spirituality that we're talking about here is a relational, right? Which I think is differentiated from religion, which is a series of activities. We're talking about people who have begun to develop that relationship with God and others through the spiritual emphasis. And listen to this. When a spiritual theme is weak, homeless persons do not seem to have the power to get on their road to recovery. Huh. Isn't that amazing? And doesn't that say something about the power and the fact that as rescue missions we have so very much more to offer than anyone else in this business? And so we should never, I don't think, ever feel that we have any less to offer or are inferior in any way to those programs. And I think someday the rest of the churches are going to wake up the fact that we could pour millions of dollars into the homeless problem, but unless people understand the spiritual dynamic, there's not going to be any major changes. The next one is self-insight, and this one, let me tell you what they said. Persons who are high on the self-insight theme, when they can make rather accurate descriptions of themselves, both in terms of their weaknesses and their strengths. Self-insight has to do primarily with the cognitive dimensions, which is the thought, the mental dimensions of a person's life. Are those dimensions about which there can be some fairly objective assessments? For example, they can be fairly objective about their own health. They can know their behavior that may be destroying themselves. And as a result of that insight, they can decide that they do want to make changes. Because they can own that there are reasons for their present condition, they can accept their current situation, plan for a better future. Many of the people who find themselves in a homeless situation have lacked discipline in their lives. When they can own that they lack discipline, then they can plan how to put some order in their lives through the help of other people and thus become more effective. When self-insight is weak, persons live in an unrealistic world. They make excuses for their condition and tend to blame other people for the situation rather than doing it about themselves. Doing something about it themselves. And so, again, the denial theme, again, is just the total opposite of self-insight, right? Because when an addict is in the world of denial, he's in total unreality. And his perspective of himself is gone, out to lunch. And when that happens, they have no, absolutely no chance of recovery. The second one, or third one we mentioned here, is security. They define security as this, which is, this very much says something about the, what we should have as the climate or the therapeutic environment of our mission. I talked about that last year in a little bit, and we'll mention it tomorrow a little bit too. When the security theme is strong, persons feel safe. Their fears that others might be trying to hurt them subside. They feel all right about their health, and they feel that they can manage their dependencies, like alcohol and drug addiction. In other words, security comes when they have a sense that their addictions are coming under control, and that they're not regaining freedom from the compulsivity to use alcohol and drugs. They also know that they have access to people they can talk to and they can live with, and that they actually have certain possessions that are important to them that they can attach themselves to. In other words, they feel they are in a situation where they're both physically and emotionally safe. And there are some things that will make our ministry physically and emotionally safe. And I think, honestly, that the emotional safety for a recovering person is more important sometimes even than the physical security aspect. The fourth thing that they talked about is self-awareness. And you have to be there's a very important distinction between self-insight and self-awareness. And I think a lot of it, we don't always think about it, but this has to be also somehow integrated into our programs if we're going to really experience success. Persons who are high on the self-awareness theme are in touch with their own emotions. That's the key. Self-insight means, you know, I understand why I do what I do, right? Self-awareness says I understand why I feel the way I do. I understand how I feel and where these feelings are coming from. They can actually identify and give names to the feelings and emotions that they feel surging through them. The emotional dimensions of their behavior enables them to remember the things, the exciting things, the difficult things that happen over a period of time. And then as they grow, they can discuss these emotions with other people and will tend to express them to other people rather than stuffing them inside. And you see what, you can see this with the people in just in that early stage of recovery and the people who aren't going anywhere. All these emotions are stuffed inside, right? And one of the things I talked about earlier with the whole the crippling shame or toxic shame issue is you're out of touch with them and you're all stuffed inside. I think Patrick was right when he says we all have feelings, but if we're not really in recovery and growing, then we just are out of touch with them. And we can't, you know, like I said, I could say I'm feeling bad, but I can't tell you whether it's jealousy or anger. I can't tell you whether it's I'm disappointed or depressed. I don't know. It says, they can talk about how they feel about their own life situation. And if it hurts, they can say that and then ask for help in making the corrections. They can own the bad things that happen to them in their life, and they can also know the good feelings that they want to achieve. And that's one of the important aspects of this coming into emotional freedom, is if I'm out of touch with the good, bad feelings, I'm also out of touch with the good feelings. If I can't feel depressed, I'm usually not going to feel joy either. Now listen to this. When the self-awareness theme is limited, people tend to be patently unmotivated. Isn't that interesting? It's almost like the people who recover are the ones who start getting excited about life again. The ones who are still lacking self-awareness are the ones who will usually be depressed and demotivated. It also says that they have little that excites them, either positively or negatively, during this numb condition. And generally, they use chemicals to sustain that way. And if they have feelings, they're confusing rather than something that drives them to action. The feeling, that whole emotional dimension is more paralyzing than it is motivating. Pretty interesting, isn't it? As we start talking about these dimensions, because there's stuff we don't always think about. Now, the fifth one, you talked about it earlier, and that's people support. But again, their observations were very unique in this area too. How did they define people support? When people are high on the people support theme, they have others who care about them. People who would care enough about them to write a letter or to pray for them. They have family members who are continuously concerned about them and know where they are. When homeless people are at their lowest level of existence, they don't have anyone, even among their family or from their friendships, who even knows where they are. And in terms of friendships, they are lost persons. The greatest wound of toxic shame is the inability to develop meaningful human relationships. We talked about that earlier. So when people are high on the people support theme, they have incoming messages of concern and love. They have people who will intentionally help them because they are friends or family. They have people who look to them, forward to seeing them. And as the people support theme develops, they have developed friends who give them recognition, praise them, and admire them. It sounds like when people support is happening in someone's life, it can lift them out of depression, can't it? It can give them a reason for doing something with their lives. And you notice, again, it says that they have recognition, praise, and admiration. And for a lot of people, it isn't very hard to give them recognition, praise, and admiration. But again, and we'll talk about this tomorrow too, some ways that in our mission setting, we can make this people support dimension a lot more of a vital part of our program. And the last one is a psychological term that I think needs a little definition for us. And when I first read it, I was a little bit turned off until I really understood what they were meaning by it. It's called suppression. But as I read their definition of suppression, I found a much better word for or definition of it, and that is reconciliation. With your past. Yep. Here's how they define the term suppression, if I can find it here. The persons who have been described as homeless and are making progress in their recovery seem to block out some of the painful, embarrassing experiences that have been a part of their life. They tend to deny depressions and worries and shyness, and don't seem to dwell on physical discomforts. They don't think of themselves as homeless persons or worthless persons. They deny poor self-concepts that they might have or others might project upon them. And as they move along in recovery, they tend to move toward an attitude of being satisfied with themselves. On the other hand, when the suppression theme is low, they'll tend to be overwhelmed with negative thoughts, and those negative thoughts will interfere with any tendencies toward growth or recovery. So I think it involves maybe two things. That is, not just reconciliation with the past, but also B is moving into a more positive thinking mode. You ever notice how negativity works in a program? It just becomes absolutely contagious, doesn't it? One of the things about this whole study, though, it's very interesting, is when the people at Gallup developed these themes and said, these are the big six reoccurring themes. These are the things that separate those who recover from homelessness from those who do not. I remember the first meeting we had with them. The first question somebody had was, that's wonderful. How do we do this? If these are the things that will make a person successful and pull out of the homeless lifestyle, tell us how we do it. And you know what they said? They said, our job is just to record and observe. It's your job now to develop something. Any questions about any of this before I go on? Yes, Patrick.
I just think it's interesting, and I've read a lot of studies on what correlations between success and losing, success and clients, etc. I think there's a difference between correlates in the beginning phase of recovery and near the middle or later stages. For instance, spirituality and self-insight and universalism and identity is very important in the beginning, whereas the emotional, people being supportive, other things like that are more important near the end. And you can clearly see the difference because when someone first comes in, what they need most is for someone to be there that they can identify with, that will take care of them or give them hope, installation of hope. Later on, the inner person needs to be taken care of with some of those things.
Right. Actually, what we're looking at here is like the end products. These are the things that we are hoping by the time someone graduates from our program, or, you know what I'm saying, while they're with us sometime, these are going to be a part of the experience they have with us. And in the beginning, let me tell you, sometimes that's probably the one thing, that's probably, you know, I really honestly think that there are only two things that people can see in our mission when they first start. That's hope and love, hope and concern. If we can create, number one in them, that there's hope for change, and number two, that there's people here that care for you, that'll get them there and keep them. And so, and if I have these two things, and I'm creating an atmosphere where this is coming around, then we'll start getting into the issues. You know what I'm saying? And I know that sometimes we get a little bit into kind of a struggle because, you know, a lot of times why people first come to the mission is, well, they need a bed, they need some food, they need some clothes. And I try to encourage mission workers to think of it the way Jesus did the thing with the loaves and the fishes, right? I mean, he met real human need to give himself an opportunity to meet spiritual need. In other words, he used the physical need as a contact point to give him an opportunity then to meet spiritual needs. And I think that's how we ought to always see that aspect of our ministry. Because how does a hungry man think about heaven when he's preoccupied with his stomach, right? How does a cold man who's slacking the elements think about eternity when he's just worried about where he's going to spend the night? Now, interestingly enough, I also have another list of items that I really believe in a very direct way supports a lot of this information and also ties very much into this whole toxic shame issue. And I want to tell you that basically when Adam and Eve fell in the beginning, right? Or if recovery means getting back to that somewhat restoration with God that once was, there were three relationships that were broken when the fall occurred. Now, we started off with the premise that this is a fallen world. And Dean Sherman, who is with a Youth of the Mission, is an excellent speaker. He has a whole video series on relationships that we used in our program that was extremely, extremely good. And I have a set of worksheets at the office in Kansas City, and information about the video set. But he goes on talks about relationships, and then a big part of it talks about relationships with the opposite sex. And if you're interested, just give me a call or get a business card and I'll send you information about it. But he said, really, that almost every issue of life is a relationship issue. And one thing I can tell you for sure, and that is the quality of relationships that you have is really determinant of the quality of life that you have. And how you're doing in the relationship area really determines how good of a life you've got. So what was the first relationship that was broken with the fall? Who did we get cut off with initially?
God.
God, right. Who was next?
Self.
And then others. That's right. So if we have any hope of getting any of these things into our lives, then these have to be restored. Agreed? Okay. So, let's say that if I'm going to be restored to God, there are some steps I've got to take. Number one is I admit my need. Number two, I need faith. Number three, I make a decision to surrender my life to God, right? That's how we get right back to God, isn't it? Agreed? Is that the biblical progression? What's that? Yeah, well, that means, yeah, repent means I admit my need, I trust the Lord, and because I trust Him, I'll turn my life over to Him, right? Okay. What about getting back in touch with myself? Number four. One of the first things I'm going to need, if I'm ever going to get back in touch with myself, is I need to know myself. Self-understanding. But just knowing myself and about myself is not going to bring healing to me, is it, totally? Because generally, if I take a true assessment of myself, the first thing I'm going to see is all my faults, right? And all my sin, and all my shame, and all my defeat, and everything that needs, that is within me, that needs to be changed. And that's where we get to the phase of really confession and forgiveness. That has to happen in my life too. The sixth thing that has to happen, though, is nobody wants to be stuck here, do we? Do you want to be stuck with an awareness of your faults and having to go back to the altar again and again and again to ask forgiveness? We got to go beyond that, don't we? Right. The next step that we need to do is what? I'd say God would be willing to change. Actually, maybe I ought to put something just a little bit better, and that is willing for God to change us. Because we understand if the more we know about ourselves, I think the more we understand that it's not going to be us who's going to do the ultimate changing, is it? It's going to be God. And the last thing we need to get reconnected to ourselves, I think, is that we need to humble ourselves and really ask God to change us. And of course, this will really create hope in us, won't it? When we get to other people, I think it's very similar to this step up here. I've got self-understanding, but now I also need to get, you might say, an assessment of relationships. And I think we notice that as we go along here, the more honest our assessment of relationships are, the more we realize that, generally speaking, the reason why our relationships are messed up is our fault. You know what I'm saying? We've destroyed relationships. We've cut ourselves off from other people. So the only other way to bring restoration to those relationships is to make amends. Or restitution, right? And that's all good. if we've done these things and a person has gotten this far, I believe that, and this is a lot from what John Bradshaw talks about in another book called Healing the Shame That Binds You, is that these things begin to get, a person gets reconnected with him, with his God. He understands that, you know, we talked about crippling shame, but there's also something called healthy shame. And healthy shame, really the best way to define healthy shame is that I have within myself understanding of my limitations. And that understanding my limitations, I also have a good awareness of God. You know what that's called? What's another Bible word for that? Humility. Right? Humility says, I understand and accept my limitations and understand where I stand in relationship to God. That's, humility is not taking a step into a lower position, is it? Humility is accepting exactly where I am. And humility, David Allender, who's a associate of Larry Crabb, wrote a paper called Humility, the Antidote for Shame. Because he said that true humility keeps me from getting out of balance. Because the imbalance of toxic shame looks like this. On one side, we have what's called grandiosity. You know what that is? You see it all the time, right? Every day in your program, probably. In other words, egotism, right? Inflated ego, whatever. That's one side of toxic shame. Superhuman. But the other side is the other side that we see, the kind of like the mirror image, the other wrong element of that one, and that's what you call worthlessness or we sometimes use the word low self-esteem. What's that? Yeah, well it's a so, I mean, this is like too positive and this is too negative. You know what I'm saying? The person's kind of like one way or the other. But becoming reconnected with God through really having a true humility means that I'm not constantly down on myself, right? Yet I'm not walking around with a big head either. It's kind of somewhere in the middle. The balance that comes through true humility in our lives. Worthless and low esteem. Worthlessness and low self-esteem. Now, okay, so, and when we look at this whole thing, I think we need to realize that let's talk about these next three is what we might say, we'll call them maintenance, okay? If a person has done these three things to begin reconnecting with these broken relationships of life, then I think the next step is a person really needs to make a continuing self-assessment. It's not like I do it one time and I'm always in touch with myself. It's like it needs to be ongoing. If I'm going to stay connected to God, and this is really a commitment to honesty in all my affairs. In this one, we need to understand that we need to develop prayer. We need to develop with personal devotions. We also need to seek God's will for our life. And then finally, the 12th thing, the last thing I want to mention today, is that we get to the place where we start reaching out to others. And I think that's where, you know, if I really begin to, you know, develop my relationship with others, the final thing will be that I begin to reach out to others. Yes. Amazing, isn't it? That's because that's what it is. What's that? Well, I want to let you know that when I wrote in this, in my question and answer thing, I wrote a little bit about where the 12 steps came from. And basically, the 12 steps were not invented by AA. They came from a Christian organization called the Oxford Groups. And they were originally 6 steps that were expanded to 12. And if you read anything back in AA literature, you find out that the original 12 steps, as penned by Bill Wilson, were very, very Christian. And it was only after a bit more people got involved with it that they kind of toned down the Christian emphasis of them. But you see, I only wanted to do this because I wanted you to understand that over the years there's been such crazy application and misuse of the 12 steps that people have come to become fearful about them and prejudice against them. And I could say there's even such a thing as 12-a-phobia. Give me 9, give me 10, but please don't give me 12 steps, you know. But if we look at this, what we have is a very logical progression to lead somebody into restoration and developing that. See, remember we talked about recovery is an ongoing program of personal growth, and these last 3 things here are the program that's ongoing: continuing assessment, spiritual development, and outreach. And let me ask you this: if you had a man at your mission who did all of these things, would he be a success? Would you feel like he did a good job with the dude? Yes. I think that's a good point. And I think that it's not like we're promoting some kind of a self-improvement program. What we're promoting is getting people reconnected with God, with self and others. And you notice that the first reconnection that we want to focus on is God, and the God that we want to connect them with is God as He has revealed Himself in Jesus Christ. And we have no reason to compromise in any way on these things. Now, so I took a look at these 12 steps, and I took a look at what the Gallup poll, Gallup people really said were the 6 success items, right? And if we asked ourselves, well, how in the world do we integrate? How in the world do we enable our people to get some of these things into their lives, right? And it became pretty apparent to me that we can take and say that in these 12 items are these things expressed in many ways over. If we say we're talking about spiritual, we're talking about 2, 3, and 11. 1, 2, 3, and 11, right? That's the spiritual development side of things. We talk about self-insight. Here we go. Steps 4 through 7. When we talk about security, What's the, you know, when we think about security, one of the things that we, I think, really need to take a look at is the simple fact that, number one, any of the steps that would deal with spiritual things will eventually also be dealing with security, because it creates hope. Also, in the first step, there's a real interesting term, and that's we. And that applies down here, too, that there's people support. If we look at self-awareness, again, steps, also, I'm sorry, self-insight, back to that, 4 through 7 and 10, again, self-awareness, 4 through 7 and 10. People support, 1, 8, and 9 are part of that. Suppression, going back to dealing with the past, we're back to steps 4 and 5, dealing with my past. Steps 8 and 9, dealing with my relationship with others. So you have a state-financed 30-day in-house rehab program. Well, it's interesting because my feeling about that is probably the most important thing you can do with those first 30 days is work on a person's denial. And that's an education. Denial and education. That's about all you can do in 30 days. And if at the end of that, by the time you get to the end of the 30 days, if that person admits his need, you've succeeded. That's what I feel. But I think that, I don't think that we should ever wait to bring in the spiritual. I think, Pat reminded me of something too, because Radio Bible Class, I don't know, has this wonderful devotional. Have you ever seen it called Our Daily Bread? They'll supply that to you mission free, and it's a wonderful devotional. And Our Daily Bread, just for your information, can be gotten by writing Radio Bible Class, Grand Rapids, Michigan, 49555. They used to send us 50 copies of every issue that came out every 3 months. That's a wonderful tool. And we could have a devotional, we could read the scriptures that go with it, and just have a nice time. And sometimes that was as therapeutic a session as any group session there ever was. So there is a lot of good material out and good 12-step based support groups. And I guess this is my way of letting you guys know that this is one tool that's very workable. Now, if you're squeamish or whatever and worry about the 12 steps, you don't, as long as you do these things with your people, you don't have to say you use the 12 steps. You know what I'm saying? But why not? I mean, you know, if it's a good orderly progression and it accomplishes what we need and what our clients need, then gee, we should do that. I also have one other thing I have here that's really an excellent tool for developing the spiritual stuff at a very low price is this information from Global Youth Evangelism. They have stuff that is both, you know, they're all Bible studies, and many of them are real cheap, like 50, 75 cents a piece. And they have studies on the entire Bible. And they also have it in Spanish. And they give certificates to people who go through their whole thing.
Would you feel that the traditional old mission style of having services every night sort of dampens our reaching the regular transient person, where we know that we get all these church organizations, church pastors coming in, they don't know what your program is, they're not instructed in what's going on, and their whole thing is salvation messages all the time. Would it be a better thing to pull in the pastors come and explain what our program is and what we'd like to see take place, or to eliminate that and be in control of that?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at this whole issue of the traditional rescue mission setting. Let me say that I am 100% convinced that 8 hours of work and mandatory attendance at a gospel service 7 nights a week is terribly unfair. And if we say we have a program and that's all we're doing, we're lying. We're not helping people, even though we claim that we are. It's almost like with church. What congregation would be happy with a pastor who only preached evangelistic sermons 52 weeks out of the year? How long would that guy keep his job? How much would that congregation grow? We have, I believe especially, people with greater needs than ever before. And what that means is there is a definite correlation between the amount of time we spend with people and how well they succeed in their lives. And the more we can do to develop individualized attention and also small group interaction, the more successful we're going to be. You remember I told you before, I mentioned this was one of my presuppositions in the beginning, the therapeutic value of self-revelation. And 12-step based support group meetings and stuff, that's what we're talking about here, is self-revelation and what a healing, affirming thing it can be. Self-revelation is suicide on the streets. You know what I'm saying? For those of you who've been there, you don't reveal your weaknesses or your struggles or your anything that's shaming to you or anything that's difficult. You don't let your guard down. You don't allow people any opportunity to come back on you and use things that you say or take advantage of you in any way, right? And that's where a lot of this toughness that we see and this defensiveness that we see comes in. Giving people an opportunity in a supportive, safe environment to reveal what's going on inside and explore their feelings and share their struggles is an intensely healing environment. And to get support and to reveal the ugliest, most embarrassing, shaming things about myself with people and still feel love and still feel support is tremendously healing. And so what I'm going to do tomorrow is try to accomplish a lot in a very short period of time. But I want to take a little bit of what I talked about last year, number one, to talk about some of the dynamic of denial and how we can use some of these principles to get people to step one. Because until people admit their need and develop, you know, that concrete sense of powerlessness, none of the rest of this will ever happen in their lives. But aside from that, I also want to talk about ways to organize your program so that a lot that, because this kind of stuff is not going to happen by itself, is it? It's going to take a deliberate effort. And let me give you a definition. I'm going to leave you a definition of what I call a program. And I want you to measure what you guys are doing to my definition of what a program is. I maybe ought to write it out for you here. If you say you have a program at your mission, what you're saying is you have a systematized approach to applying your resources. And by resources, I mean both in-house, whether it be staff, education, work, etc., and community, which means via referral and bringing outside people in, to the individualized needs of your clients. Stressing the word individual. Systemized approach to applying your resources to the individual needs of your clients. And that implies, number one, that you have a schedule of activities, you have a plan. A plan and a schedule for applying the resources. That you, number one, you know what your resources are. Number two, that you know what the needs of your client truly are. I think we run into a lot of trouble when we treat people kind of like a herd. And I think a lot of our people feel like cattle being pushed through the stockyards that we call rescue missions. Because there's nobody there who takes the time to know them as an individual and to know what their needs are. And then what sometimes happens is if I don't have a systemized approach and a vehicle for understanding individual needs, then I'm not going to meet needs because I don't know what they are. But we could say, yes, they need to know God, amen. But they also need self-insight and security and self-awareness. They need real people support. And see, all of these are needs. And so tomorrow we'll talk a little bit about how to have the systemized approach, how to assess resources, and how to meet needs. Any questions or thoughts here before we close? Yes?
One little, this is just a pocket little question.
Okay.
The table thing there, other than the book, the golf and the DLS, how does that work?
Yeah, everything but the books and tapes are free. So take as much of it as you want.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, men.
Okay, fellas, before you take off here, I'm just going to have a